than a gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Angelo Viola. He is Peter Bowman.
Hi.
Our usual staff. Well, no, minus one. We have Volvo.
Give me a hell yeah.
We have Nick missing. Ooh, and we have Dean Taylor.
Come on now.
On the board doing the come on now.
Come on now.
Attaboy. This is the another edition of the show where we feature Fish Talk with the Doc.
Come on now.
Yeah. How exciting is that?
Hell yeah. Exactly. Do that one too, Dean, for sure. That's a Clint Eastwood moment there.
Joining us today is Dr. Zachary Feiner.
Come on now.
That is correct. He is a fisheries ecologist.
Ecologist. We've always had biologists on. Yeah. This is an ecologist, right?
Do we know the difference?
This is because he's more of into the water more than the fish, right?
He's specializing in limnology.
Yes. Do you know what that is? Hang on a second. Do you know
please,
what that is?
Please.
Put a pause on that camera. Page two.
While he does
I should do a Don King on that one. We shouldn't. It is the study of inland aquatic ecosystems.
That's correct.
So versus probably the study of actual fish themselves, right?
Dr. Feiner will be joining us
there
later
he is.
On.
Look at that. Handsome gentleman.
Handsome, good-looking young man. He's also fisheries ecologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, as well as the Madison Center for Limnology, specializing in eco-evolutionary impacts of fish recruitment, food web ecology, invasive species biology, and anglerfish interactions. And that's what we want to talk to him about.
When are we going to get titles like that?
You can put it. I don't. Your cards, you're supposed to out of business cards. Before I order them, let's just sit down in my office and talk it over.
We'll put a bunch of this
on
our cards. We really should. You know what I mean?
I think it'd be great.
I think it'd be awesome. Look at us go.
I like it.
Bobby Dazzler.
Put letters, especially letters with little slashes and underscores and stuff.
I love it.
I think that's it.
Nobody's going to question it. We've been around long enough, right?
Exactly.
That's it.
Anyways, that's all coming up later on our regular feature. Dean tells me, monthly, is that what we're going to do with Fish
Talk?
Yeah,
I think monthly, yeah. Yeah, every four episodes or so, we'll put one in.
Yeah, we had Stephen Cook on already, and he's going to be a regular. If Zachary here joins the club, he'll be a regular, and we'll just
rotate. We could have a whole
whack
of them.
Docs.
12 different docs. So once a month, we'd have 12 different docs in there. How good would that be?
Like a whole back bay of docs we'll have.
Oh!
We'll have docs everywhere. Thank you.
There you go.
Wonderful program. Besides Dr. Zeiner joining us, we also have...
That's a combination of Zach and Feiner, right?
Sure, Zeiner.
Zeiner. Feiner. I like that. So you're just condensing everything.
That's what King used to do, right? That's perfect.
We have Zeiner. Dr. Zeiner. That's a combination of Zachary and Feiner. I love that guy.
God almighty. We got to stop being idiots like that.
I love being an idiot. It's my life.
Well, you're wearing the shirt for. By the way, you look handsome in that.
That is
a very handsome looking shirt on
you.
I don't know
Angelo.
Whether it's the color combinations or.
I've always been a yellow kind of guy. I like the yellow combo.
Looks
you know,
very nice.
And that little red highlighter, orange, I guess you call it, kind of a highlighter.
By the way, just as an FYI for you folks, watching this. This was a limited edition piece that the folks at Campus Crew offered us to put on our site, which we did. And it was going to be a one of, but because of its overwhelming popularity, guess what? We're going to come back with a
give
second
me a hell
edition.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
There you go.
Why not, right? If their people are liking it and they want to buy it, let's supply them.
And that's all available, by the way. If you go to fishingcanada.com and press the store button, you'll see all of the different garments, including what I've got on and hoodies. And the new spring stuff is on its way, apparently.
I like a lot of them. Those new hoodies are great.
Oh, they're fantastic.
They're awesome.
But the new spring stuff is coming out. A couple of new designs. Some of them we unveiled at the Toronto Sportsman Show recently.
Correct.
Which are not even on the site yet, by the way.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, they're not there, apparently. But they're going up very soon as well. So all kinds of great things happening.
It's a total new look for us. Those new hoodies is a total new look for us. Yeah. Kind of getting away from our branding of that, what Angela's going there. Yeah. But still, it still has very much Fish in Canada and just some cool new looks. So, yeah.
All right. That's all happening at fishingcanada.com along with the usual stuff.
Or shop.fishingcanada.com.
Come on now.
The back door. You like the old back door?
Got to give them every option here because some people might, you know, just all of a sudden say, hey, I got a shop at Fish in Canada. I wonder how I can put that together. Shop.fish. Hey, there I go. You know what I mean?
While you're there, then the back door, front door, however you got there through the attic, it doesn't really matter. Also, while you're there, take the poll and tell us what you would like to see. In the store. I mean, we're throwing all kinds of stuff out there based on what we hear at Central Operations like.
The attic and Central Operations.
Right?
I'm loving this.
Base camp. Not no, it's not.
Exactly.
Stop it.
Yes, okay. Jimmy, you know it, buddy.
Base camp. Here at base camp, you tell us what you want to see there, and we'll make it happen for you.
At the heart of the reactor.
That is correct, my friend. Listener feedback comes to us from the Silver Niner.
I love that name.
At the Silver Niner. Am I missing something there? Or is that just
Silver Desk?
Nothing.
I love the way these handles come out.
There's the people, Silver Niner via YouTube. We're getting a lot of you guys on YouTube.
That's good.
Which is kind of cool.
That's good. That's cool.
In response to catching giant BC lake trout, Fishing Canada episode. This is what the Silver at the Silver Niner is responding to. He says, Pete kills me. That is a bass fisherman to the T. You can take the bass fisherman away from the bass, but you can't take that hook set out of the bass fisherman.
I love it.
Every time he hooks up, he tries to yank the fish right into the boat.
That is so true.
Respond.
You know what? To me, one of my favorite parts of fishing is the hook set. That initial bite to setting the hook. There's something so adrenaline pumping about that to me in the fishing, the fight and everything else. Of course, it all happens, but that hook set is so, I don't know why. And he's right. Now, in that case, I'm going to say we're fishing in 40 to 50 feet of water with these giant swim baits and we got these big hook on them. You know what I mean? It's like a 3-aught hook at least on it, a single hook. You a lake trout like that, that's got a hard mouth on it. You have to pound it good, right? We were running braided line. Look at you. I know you're waiting to say something. You got that look in your face, Viola, now.
I'm admiring the wonderful scenery.
You got to hit them hard. If you want to make sure that hook penetrates, you got to hit them hard. So it's just part of the game to me. I like slamming them. I like it. It's fun to me, but I like that. You can't take the bass fisherman out of it.
That's great.
That's awesome.
I was going to say,
here we go, ladies and boys and girls and children of all ages.
I never noticed on that image before, but you look like you're a little constipated and you're trying to relieve yourself.
Well, I'm holding up 30 pounds of Laker, okay?
Okay.
Trying to look pretty.
I've seen that look before.
Maybe I'm farting. Maybe I'm letting a little fart going there.
All I'm saying is I've seen that look on you before.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know where, strange. But I know I've seen it. while you're there at Fishing Canada, by the way, thank you very much to, what was that? At
Silver Niner.
Silver Niner.
The Silver Niner.
The Silver Niner. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your
question. I have any comments that you would like to pass on to us, by all means. And they can do it, Dean, through various different means, right?
YouTube. We take emails, Instagram messages, wherever you can get it.
YouTube.
I read them all.
YouTube.
Can I ask you?
Thank you for watching YouTube, by the way.
Oh,
for watching our YouTube.
Can I ask you a personal question, Dean?
Yeah.
Why don't you get a mic stand for your mic?
I was only made aware today that I was able to do that. I thought you liked me having this mic.
You probably made a comment about him being so ambidextrous and we're using both hands with a pen at the board. Now you're going to tell him to get a mic stand. Now, when are you going to make your mind up, Viola?
Would you like a mic stand?
I would love a mic stand, yeah. It's not that fun.
Wonder if we could get a higher tripod so we don't have to look up Dean's nose either. I wonder if we could get a little bit.
That's
not what the audience sees. I got a high camera here.
We get the nose view Okay. And we know how it is now.
Because
okay.
I thought the price of those.
Okay, so your camera,
high.
Where's your camera?
Up here. You guys are down here.
Ah, okay. Now I'm looking over. I'm seeing confused. The GoPro over there. Are we going to have to? Yeah. I'm going to take a picture of this thing.
We've got so many things going on here.
Yes. Look at
What are you taking a picture of?
Just Dean's setup. So we'll post this and say, okay, this is the point of both cameras, Dean. Could you point up both cameras for me?
There, and there.
There we go. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you, Dean.
All right.
So,
are we good now, or can we move on?
That's for my own personal
photo
album.
So, listener feedback, make sure you reach out to us if you want to give us an opinion on what's happening here on the show. All right? Like, for example, some of you might not like me having a cup of coffee there. I don't know. Let us know. I'm just saying.
You think, come on, do you think they're that, there's somebody there that's that shallow?
I'm just saying. Giving you all sorts of opportunities.
What they're mad about is that you're disguising whiskey as coffee because you got a glass of pure whiskey there. You know what I mean? Because they don't really know the real you. That they should complain about. Just tell us you're drinking whiskey, Ange. That's it. 40 Creek?
You look like you are trying to relieve yourself.
Squeeze one out. Yeah. I'm squeezing one out the front of the boat there.
While you're on fishercanada.com, you might also want to check out the reviews and the things that we put up there about our podcast network. A lot of you might not be aware of the fact that this is a network, not just a show. And right now, if you go there, you'll see that we've got, we're highlighting Diaries of a Lodge Owner.
Give me a hell yeah.
I love that.
I love that.
Nice whole setup.
Did you create that, Dean?
I created that, yeah.
Wow.
He was never even there.
You're so talented.
He wasn't even there.
You're wasting away.
And that was a muskie, but he replaced it with a walleye. Musky, yeah.
You're wasting away here. Like, you should, I don't know where you should be, but.
I like it here.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll talk. See how long we can keep you around. Diaries of a Lodge Owner with our good friend Steve Nedzwicki, co-host on the Fish in Canada show.
Come on now.
Which, by the way, you will see the lovely, the talented Dean Taylor in this new series coming up that we'll be shooting this year.
Come on now.
Got big plans for Dino?
Got some plans for Dino.
Okay.
Got some plans for Dino.
Excited to hear them.
We'll see how they work out.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, is he going to be under scrutiny?
If he's good, he's good.
I'm not if he's at bad, liberty. He's gone.
I'm sworn to secrecy.
He's not on the walk of the plank, is he? And you're going to be like
that'd be a great image. I just saw that in my head. Walking the plank on FNC1.
Okay, Dean, catch a fish or else.
Or else, yeah. Anyways, our good friend Steve Nedzwicki interviews Will. Palowski of Nordic Point Lodge that we'll be shooting at this coming year. By the way, is it me or I look like I'm in the dark? Am I dark?
It's just the webcam.
Oh, it's just the webcam?
Yeah.
Like it looks Dean's like nose cam. It looks like he's
all lit up and I'm talking from the shadows. You know, I'm from the shadows.
Walking the Shadows. Queensbreak. Great rock band.
From Nordic Point Lodge, a wonderful place that we'll be visiting this summer and shooting an episode there. And Steve has a wonderful interview with Will. And we spent some time with Will at the recent
show. A little bit. We didn't get to see him too much, though, did we? No, he was a busy boy. He was running back and forth and to and fro. Boy,
he talks about his marketing strategies as a lodge owner, which is very cool. Success stories, et cetera, et cetera. So catch it all on the fishincanada.com podcast network highlights.
Come on now.
There you go. In the news, my friend, what's happening?
Well, them big old bears are coming out of hibernation in Ontario due to the mild temperatures. As we were talking about with Stephen, Fish Talk with the Doc, and we will be talking about with our new Fish Talk with the Doc. It's all about this crazy spring we're having here. This ridiculous, unbelievable, fast spring.
By the way, you know bears when they come out of caves, like from hibernation,
they come out ours first.
They go through a period of constipation. Were you aware of that?
Like I was like in that
and that photo picture, that was the had right you there. It could have been a bear coming out of
there's
a cave.
A bear, too. He's not as constipated as I was. No. Well, that's not spring. The ferns are green there, so.
No. Could be somewhere.
Our Dean, our Photoshop guy, should have changed that up a little bit.
That's why I'm still here.
You should have caught that for sure. Maybe just painted everything brown.
So they come out constipated. Is that what you said?
They do for a short period of time because they haven't gone through their regular
digestive. They don't poop at all? No,
they have some issues. All I'm saying is that they probably all look like you in that photo.
Well, think about that. If you sleep for how many weeks do they sleep for? How long is a bear hibernation, Dean?
Oh, they go in like well, now, like late December, and then wake up. They wake up a few times, though, in the winter, but they don't really have anything. I don't think they have anything to eat.
They don't eat, so they live off their fat. They're eating, and they live off the fat, right?
It's maybe like 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
So it takes a while.
That'd be you up at a lodge with an outhouse. I've done, man, should be hibernating for 3 months before you take a shit. We've seen it before.
Yes, we have, my friend.
The provincial government released a statement warning residents to be bear wise, as officials have received reports of the animals coming out of hibernation already. And this is March. Yeah. This is would be crazy. Normally, like in March, the snow is leaving in March, but it's been gone for a while, like in southern Ontario-ish. And there's bears around here. It's not that far north of us that there are black bear populations. So this is very early for these things to be out and about. Now, you're always going to be careful, be bear conscious and bear wise all the time, but but they're all being earlier. They're going to be scrounging around earlier for food too, right?
Yeah, normally when they wake up in the middle of winter, they'll stick their nose out and check out the winter and the snow, and they'll go back to sleep. But yeah, the fear now, according to biologist Annie Langwa, is that bears, once they wake up now, they may look out there and see that greenery, and they think, hey, it's time to get up.
Yeah, there's probably bears out right now.
Confusion.
Yeah.
It's going to be great confusion.
Yeah. And I mean, it's obvious. You always have to be bear-wise, right? I remember a time we went to Algonquin Park. So my dad, very quick story, my dad grew up in way up in northern Ontario, and his dad was a trapper, a fur farmer, et cetera, et cetera. They actually had two bear cubs for pets. So they had a brown bear and a black bear for pets.
What, they taught them to fight or something?
The brown bear, my dad taught him to box. That was the demise of those bears, because that brown bear was apparently a shit disturber. And he went up and popped my grandfather one day when he was smoking a cigar, and they were gone to the circus or the fair, whatever it was. He said, they're gone the next day.
Was he like a chocolate phase black bear or like an actual brown bear?
I'm going to say a chocolate phase. I think they were brothers, sisters, siblings, probably.
Yeah.
The orphaned cubs. So I'm going to say, it wasn't a brown, it was a brown collared bear, I guess you'd call it, right? So, but totally different personalities. The black bear was this very shy, docile, and the brown bear was just a shit disturber, apparently. So, but anyways, I remember one story quickly. We were going to Algonquin Park, and my dad, being the absolute idiot that he was, he got out of the friggin' car, and there's a bear, everybody's looking at a bear, and he hand-fed a bear in Algonquin Park, like hand fed him. Some, I don't know what he gave him. I can't remember what he gave him. But he
that's
just
a no no man.
I know it is. We didn't realize, and we were kids. But I'll remember that because I'm thinking, oh, my dad's gonna die here. And the bear came over and he just grabbed something like out of his hand and then took off. And I thought, wow. Anyways, that's not bear wise.
Gordy was the bear whisperer by the sounds of it.
He must have known what he was doing, because he went out with all the confidence in the world, I guess, by raising bears.
Do not do that,
people. Gordy was a bit of an anomaly, that's for sure.
Do not do that. Generally, bears, though, in all fairness, you hear all kinds of stories. Usually, the reason that there's any interaction or negative interaction with bears is because humans don't behave the way they should with a wild animal,
right?
Because honestly, bears, unless they are provoked, a mother bear with cubs, provoked to her means if you come between her and her cubs, you're provoking her, and there could be some action taken on her behalf. Otherwise, bears under normal conditions, if they hear you, that's why a lot of people never see bears. There's bears around, but they hear you. They're gone.
Smart. They're gone. So smart. Right? That's why you see bear hunters hunting over baited areas, because you go stalking a bear, you never will not shoot one. You won't get one. You know what I mean? The other problem is that
what do you think of that, by the way?
I'm not a real fan of that. No,
I'm not either.
No, I'm not a real fan. I know.
Nothing to do with hunters. Yeah. Nothing to do with hunting.
I think it's good for the population control if it need be, what I mean? Then you got to keep the numbers down to that's what hunting's all about, really, as much as it is for a sport and for food. There's a population thing. But the other thing, the problem with bears right now is they're encroaching on our areas too, right? Not just like Gordy's thing. He went and did the opposite They're coming in, like Sudbury is a classic example, where all of a sudden you wake up in the morning and there's a bear in your backyard, or mom bear and two cubs or whatever in your backyard, scrounging through your garbage and looking in your garden and stuff like that. So you got to be very careful with that too, right? So
I think all the lighting is directed towards you. looking at that.
You're an idiot.
I just looked at that right now.
Oh, my God.
It's kind of tilted all towards
you. Yeah, well, it never was. You see, back in the day, before the Sportsman Show, it was all on you. So maybe the boys have finally said, there's finally an excuse to get Petey back in the limelight.
Maybe we should get our own light. Maybe rather than get a mic stand for Dean, he can hold the damn thing. He's got two hands. Maybe we should take the money and splurge on getting me a separate light.
We got those two lights right there that are lighting up Dean, and we could just bring them over here.
There's lots of light on Dean. I'm not worried about that.
I got one behind me there.
You got one on you there.
Hair
you got,
light there.
You got the main light on you. Dean's got. I don't see any light on me here anywhere. Yeah, well,
what are you trying to say?
I don't know what it means, but.
There's a bunch of motion.
Bova's going to be gone for a little while. Maybe we can make some changes while he's gone.
Bears are a bit of a menace right now. So
where?
Nothing, everywhere right now in the southern part where we're thawing out. So remember, they could even be aggressive towards small animals, et cetera, et cetera. Be very careful, that's all.
And that's right now. If you want more information on that, we have that happening on the news on fishinghammer.com. Is that it?
Come on now.
That's right.
Is that it?
Come on now.
Yeah, instead of us hacking up a story, go there and
like
read it.
We just did.
Yeah, but we had fun with it, though.
Never
I got some Gordyism in there, too, right?
We got everything in there.
Got a little bit of everything in there.
You know, never let
Sudbury. Sudbury, Ontario.
You threw Sudbury.
Hey, Sudbury just... Saturday night. Hey, Shorzy, you ever watch that? You watch that show, Shorzy? Have you watched that?
No.
Oh my God, it's so funny. It's it's a hockey show. It's a derivative of Letterkenny.
What's the one with the guy from Trailer Park? Oh God.
Well, it's kind of like the Trailer Park Boys. It's kind of like that, but it's exactly the same idea, but it's all to do with hockey and the Sudbury hockey team. And it's funny. That's anybody good. Wants to have some good, dumb entertainment, good Canadian dumb entertainment from Sudbury, Shorzy, just check it out.
Which leads us to the fan question of the week, boys and girls. Comes to us from Carmine Bianco from Ontario. That's cool. There's been a lot of Western Canada influence. And we had one from the U.S., I think, recently, too.
Correct.
So now it's Carmine Bianco from Ontario via email. If you've got a question, just go to info@fishincanada.com, jot it down. And send it off to us, and Dean will make sure that it gets read. What's the process, Dean? Yeah, you're getting on that button. I see your finger on that button. I'm not even going there because I know you're gonna give me a. That's a bunch of bullshit.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, you did it anyways. All right, but you can. You're not limited to info@fishincanada.com.
No. I take emails. I take Instagram messages, YouTube comments. Wherever you find us.
And he has a very fair way of making sure that all voices are heard.
Well,
fairness.
However, this question is a very good question. So if you have a very, very good question.
Are you saying the other ones weren't good?
Well, I'm saying this is the way you get read.
Oh.
So the ones that have been read have been very good. This is an extremely good question.
Carmine wants to know, Carmine says, how often to change braided line on a reel? ? Tournament pros change their line before each event. Excessive or required? Do you guys re-spool before shooting an episode to make sure the big one doesn't get away when it really matters? So, I personally think it's excessive. However, I was guilty of that while tournament fishing. There's something about being in tournament mode that is totally different than any other fishing scenario. And you want to, it's such a difficult pastime, we'll call it, because I don't think, it's a profession in some parts of the world, but it's such a difficult thing to do that you want to try and stack all the odds in your favor. And as a retired tournament angler, I'll tell you, you turn over every stone to get those helpful little things. Line changing was one of them. I remember Reno and I, we took it to a whole different level. We used to change our line after pre-fishing. So we would spool on new line to pre-fish, which would be, 2-3 days.
From four days, yep.
And then on Friday night, part of the ritual was to strip everything off of everything that we had.
Yeah.
And re-spool everything on fresh and new. And sometimes we would even do it between the 2 days of the tournament.
Well, that's what I think Buddy's saying that too every day, right?
It's, in my opinion, way excessive now. Now that I can look back at it, but yeah. Talk to real serious tournament anglers, I'll bet you they'll say, "Are you kidding me? It's a necessity."
See, here's my take on it. Let's go back. Let's go to the second part. He says before shooting an episode. So with he's talking about braided line specifically here.
Yeah.
So with braid, no, we actually will run braid for the whole season pretty much. Mm-hmm. Like it'll be maybe if we have 10 to 13 shoots or whatever that we'll use that braid throughout the whole season. We may rip off 5 or 10 feet of the, you know, the exposed braid because normally we're running leaders on top of that after that braid anyways. As a rule, we're running a fluorocarbon leader. Fluorocarbon line's a whole different story. Hybrid's a whole different story. But braid, you can get away with braid. You can get away with braid for 2 years. Honestly.
I believe that.
It is that good nowadays that if you have a good quality braid lasting the whole season, you should not have an issue with that. And you know what? You'd think that like we were, Anson and I were just talking to the Yozuri guys at the Sportsman Show, and
we learned something new there. Maybe we should share. Go ahead.
Okay, their braided line among as well as all their lines. So their Yozuri Super Braid is made in their own factory. So it's not bought. It's not have a brand on it. It's been made over in China or wherever like that. This is made in Japan at Yozuri's factory with very strict, you know, conditions. So when you use that line once, all you have to do is convert over there once and you're going to say, wow, this is a good line. And you'll never move back to anything else because it's got a good price point. But more importantly, it's very good quality a line. And that being said, when we're saying only use it once a year, Yozuri gets that. They know that we're not going to sell one person 10 spools a year. Okay, let's sell them one good spool a year and they will re-spool all their rods with this, you know, different size lines, but and it'll be good to go for the year. So it is that good nowadays that no, we do not, I mean, under any circumstances, change it every time out. Fluorocarbon, when it gets stretchy, when it gets curly or something like that, yeah, we will change that out. Hybrid, not so much. Hybrid lasts longer than you think, too, which is a combination. But for the most part, no. For braid, stuff's so good nowadays.
Just to add to that, keep in mind, we also, I would say 99% of the time, we have a leader tied onto that braid. So any of the rough stuff that you would encounter while fishing is all taken up by the leader,
yep.
Not the braid.
The braid
itself.
doesn't touch any of that stuff.
So now we change that leader during our day on a regular basis,
yeah,
depending on the activities. But we learned something interesting. And by the way, one other time that you would change your braid, if you have a novice angler on the boat that's learning how to bait cast and you give them one of your favorite bait cast reels to play around with, you probably should change the line at the end of the day because you pulled out so many bird's nests. We had an experience last year with some wonderful people we had on the boat.
You pretty well get the scissors out because you can't pull that backlash out. You gotta just cut it and throw it away. 68 different pieces.
But here's something we learned just recently, and in all the years, I never gave this any thought at all. So the use of leaders has been popular. Fly fishermen obviously have been doing it forever, but spin and bait cast anglers, probably about 20 years or so, you're really starting to hear about using lighter line for your tippet or your leader.
Listen to you, fly fishing guy, eh? Tippet. I know. Dino?
And
I like it.
And here's something that I just personally learned, and that is, because I always take my leader material from my regular line. So if we have a
Yozuri
T7, for example, I'll just rip off 6 feet, 8 feet, whatever I need, and tie it onto my braid. Well, guess what? The leader material that you can buy specifically for leader material is different than just pulling line off of a regular spool. Dean, you knew this. By the way, you're looking with that smirk.
I knew them because I talked to them at ICAST, and he's explaining this to me. And I think they borrowed that from the fly fishing world, and they're trying to kind of promote that.
So if Dean knew this at the ICAST that you were at, and Chris and you and I had a phone call about 2 years ago, and I asked that exact question, and he told us that, I'm wondering why you can't remember that.
I don't twice. Know. That's a great question, but you seemed awful surprised when he said that.
I was playing along your game.
Oh, you were feeding me.
Chris, I think Chris probably thought, who are these idiots? For I told him this twice now. What is the hell is going on? No, he did tell us years ago, and that was
the
properties are a full spool of fluorocarbon is nice and soft and supple. It goes on and it's really nice to work. It works really nice. Right. The leader material is now what fluorocarbon used to be. Remember, we used to get the fluorocarbon; it was really stiff and it was curled up and all that. Well, they still do that quality that because it's more abrasion resistant. They don't need to have it soft and supple. They make it as tough as they possibly can in that, let's say, 8 pound category. So there's still the same pound test, but it's just a tougher line. So and it sits straight and it's a little stiffer and it's better for a leader.
Now, the next time I
talk to Chris. Chris, I'm going to get him to tell you just one more time. I'm going to say, Chris, now let's just reiterate this with Angelo here, okay, just to make sure that maybe once a year, every 6 months, maybe we should be telling him. Go ahead.
I was going to say, next time I make that comment here, you can remind me. All of you can remind me. Hey, you said that a year ago. Remember you told us something?
There you go. There's audience participation right there.
That's what I call it.
Love it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming along. The humble goldfish, everyone's favorite aquatic pet. It's small, easy to care for. What's there not to love?
Even the cat may be mesmerized by the color and movements of your aquarium friends. Goldfish are great at home, but don't let them loose.
Releasing goldfish or other domestic aquatic pets or plants into natural environments is harmful to both your pet and the planet.
Goldfish disrupt ecosystems by outcompeting native species for food and resources in degraded habitats. They contribute to algae blooms, they kill aquatic wildlife, and pass viruses and diseases contracted in aquariums to wild fish.
They could even live up to 40 years and grow as big as a football. Anglers, this is where you come in. If you find a goldfish at your local fishing spot, report it to the invading species hotline or go online to eddmaps.com.
Remember to never dump your live bait into the water and risk spreading other aquatic invaders. Keep our lakes free from invaders and don't let them loose.
How did a small town sheet metal mechanic come to build one of Canada's most iconic fishing lodges? I'm your host, Steve Nidzwicki, and you'll find out about that and a whole lot more on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network's newest podcast, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. But this podcast will be more than that. Every week on Diaries of a Lodge Owner, I'm going to introduce you to a ton of great people, share their stories of our trials, tribulations, and inspirations. Learn and have plenty of laughs along the way.
Meanwhile, we're sitting there bobbing along trying to figure out how to catch a bass. And we both decided one day we were going to be on television doing a fishing show.
My hands get sore a little bit when I'm reeling in all those bass in the summertime, but that's might be for more fishing than it was punching.
You so confidently you said, "Hey, Pat, have you ever eaten a drum?"
Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, time for a little fish talk with the doc on this episode. The doc happens to be Zachary Finer, fisheries ecologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Madison Center for Limnology, which he is going to explain to us right now.
Oh, I know what it is. The study of inland aquatic ecosystems, Angelo.
Get rid of the paper.
Just in case you were wondering, okay?
Welcome to the program, Zach.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So this particular fish talk with the doc is kind of prompted by listeners and viewers of the show who are asking the question. We recently had Dr. Stephen Cook on, and we talked about the effects that this crazy weather that we're having in this part of the world right now, how it might affect fish in general. But we've been getting a lot of questions on how it's going to affect walleye specifically. And I know that that's an area that you've done some work in before, Zach. So maybe you can share that with us. What do you think is going to happen moving down the road with this?
Question for Zach first. Are you having the same crazy spring that we are in Wisconsin that we are here in Ontario? Because we're having like an insanely warm one. Are you too?
We're having an incredibly crazy spring. Yeah, okay. The earliest ice-offs on our lakes, I'm in the Madison area of Wisconsin, which is southern Wisconsin, earliest ice-offs in 175 years of record-keeping here.
Wow.
So not just crazy, but craziest, I think, is what we're looking at for this spring.
Okay.
So you don't have, we don't expect you to have a whole lot of data on what this could, what sort of effect this could have on walleye, because you just said this is the first
175 years ago.
But you must be...
Okay, we're good. I lost my audio. Did you lose it too?
No, I'm good, buddy.
Must be that.
We don't care about you.
How many as long times as you got video, because this face, the you video. Cannot exactly. miss out on this face, exactly. okay?
That's all I need to say is point to your t-shirt.
Sorry, Zach.
So it's not like you guys can go back to the reference books and say, okay, so in 1832, here's what happened to the walleye. How do you go through this process of determining what this might have in terms of ramification on their survival?
Sure. I mean, so you'd actually be surprised at how much data we have on walleye. I mean, people love to fish for walleye, right? And they're an incredibly well-studied species in this part of the world. So we actually have records of, you know, the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, going out and collecting eggs from walleye going all the way back to the 1930s. So in some places we do have coming up on a century of records on, you know, what the spawn timing is of walleye. And then at the same time, we also have really amazing records of ice off, like I mentioned, in some places going back more than a century, century and a half. Okay. So, you know, we do have a pretty good capability to think about, you know, what the historic springtime conditions have been and what historic spawnings look like for walleye and just how much that has changed over time here and how extreme it's really gotten, especially in the last few decades. We're seeing, like I said, some of the not just earliest, but also latest ice offs and spawning that we've ever seen. So it's not just getting earlier. It's also getting much more unpredictable and variable over time.
We need that. You and I need that. We need somebody to keep a record. Dean, can you keep records for us from now on about the fish that we catch? Because
I'm doing in my notebook.
It shouldn't be that hard because we haven't caught that many in the last 12 months or so. So he could probably do it with one hand.
God. Anyways, sorry.
Interesting. All right. So what can you give us? What do you think this could lead to?
Sure. So we recently published a study looking at walleye, and what we found is that there's a couple of major things that are happening. One is that, you know, as you might expect, on average, ice off, the time the ice melts off the lake is getting earlier over time, which I think, you know, warmer springs like this one is a crazy one, much earlier ice off. What we found is that walleye spawning was historically pretty tightly linked. They spawn right after ice goes off usually. But over time, they're actually starting to lag behind ice off. They're not changing as fast. So ice off is getting earlier about 3.5 times faster than walleye spawning is over time. So they're falling further and further behind ice off as we kind of go forward. They just don't have the capacity to keep up with the pace of climate change that we're seeing. And then the second half of this is when we looked at kind of the mismatch, the amount of lag between ice off and walleye spawning, that was a really strong indicator of poor recruitment. So you have a bigger lag, a bigger mismatch, and you had poor survival of those young walleye. You didn't really have the production of that next generation of walleye. So we think this is a really, really important kind of stressor on walleye populations that's really preventing them from pulling off those big year classes that, you know, historically that's what kind of supports your population over time, right?
Right.
And you're getting more and more of those kind of bust years where you don't get that next generation of fish produced. And that in the long term could really imperil walleye in a lot of places.
So Zach, the ice off, I'm going to assume that ice off, you know, is in that the water is in the mid 30s, 30 degree temperatures. Yet walleye apparently spawn in the low to mid 40s. So if it's just a straight ice off, can they spawn in 38, 39 degree water? Does it have to be a certain temperature? Because we talked to Stephen Cook. He said, not just water temperatures, the moon phase, it's the whole system around it that works. But can they spawn in colder water? Does that make a difference?
They can. I think they do prefer to wait until it's, you know, like we talked about, you mentioned in the 40s. But I think what happens is that you can actually have in very early years, the water stays cold And another really important indicator that tells walleye when to spawn is day length. So getting longer days in the springtime, they like to spawn here in Wisconsin when your day lengths are 13 and a half, 14 hours, which is corresponds to like a mid-April, late April kind of time of year. Mm-hmm. So if it goes too late and it's too cold and those day lengths start to line up, then they'll go. And then they might be spawning in temperatures that are not optimum for kind of the development of eggs, because the hatching of eggs really depends on water temperature. If it's cold, it takes them a long time. It leaves those eggs kind of exposed to the elements and more susceptible to getting eaten or kind of getting covered up and smothered before they hatch. If it's late and it's warm, they can hatch really, really quickly. So that's another kind of issue with this mistiming, is that it can actually affect the development of the eggs as well.
Hmm. One of the other concerns that was brought up recently on the show was the fact that, obviously temperature is a big factor here. But one of the other concerns, because we've had so little snowfall, quite frankly, this year, is water levels. In previous years where we've had much more snowfall, we've still had shallow water in the spring because there's not as much runoff. And even in those cases, there were a lot of up here, a lot of walleye spawning beds that were exposed with no water on them. This year, it's going to go up a level or two. That has got to be a concern as well for walleye specialists like yourself.
Yeah, the water level does seem to be really important for kind of either giving them access to or preventing access to those spawning areas, right? I'm be interested to see what happens here in Wisconsin. We actually got very, very little snow in Wisconsin this year. So, you know, how that affects water levels. Here in the Madison area, water levels seem to be way down in our lakes. So whether that exposes those spawning beds and prevents them to access those really good habitats is going to be something interesting to see. I know in other places like reservoirs, water level management is actually something that people actively do to try and promote walleye, to kind of inundate those spawning areas in the springtime. In a natural lake, it's much harder to do that, but I think it's something to keep an eye on, because that's another issue with climate change, right? You're changing your precipitation, the amount of evaporation, the amount of recharge of these lakes, and that's going to be changing water levels and, it, you know, changing the habitat that's available to these fish.
Hmm. You know, something that I was just thinking when he said that, when Zach said that, is our system here, a lot of our system here is run by dams, et cetera, locks, dams. Locks. And I wonder if our M&R is going to say this year is a bad year. It looks like a bad year coming up. So let's start dropping more water from Lake Superior down Lake Huron through the system. You know what I mean?
So the obvious answer would be?
They should.
Absolutely. But not as a slag towards M&RF. But there are factors at play that are totally removed from the ministry itself.
What is the, what are those factors?
Well, there's water levels on our whole system floating right down to the ocean through the St. Lawrence River. And so if you every time you change the water levels in a body of water, you're going to alter something downstream. And in this case, we have three provinces.
Correct.
Below but those levels here.
My way of thinking is it's already too low as for normal pool. So they should at least get it up to normal pool to begin with, shouldn't they?
No. The reason I can tell you that with total certainty, I remember on the old radio show. This used to be a radio show, by the way, Zach, before we turned it into a podcast. I remember a few years ago having officials on the program because either Bob Cage, I think it was Bob Cajun, or one of those lock systems, those little towns not far from here, the local citizens said, hey, guys, the water level is going to be so low this spring because we had poor snow that the primary spawning beds for walleye in this area, call it Bob Cajun, is going to be entirely exposed throughout the entire spawn period.
Right.
So we need to get the water levels up.
And they said
they huddled in a room and they said, we can't do it because if we do it here, it's going to have severe effects downstream in the provinces below. So it's a problem. It's not just as easy, is it, Zach, as just turning the valve and raising water levels here when you got probably 100 plus communities down below that are needing the water, or even above, because when you open the tap here, you're also going to drain it from above, right?
It just seems like it's such an endless supply of Lake Superior. Let's start up there.
Yeah.
The amount of water that they have is like, oh my God, let a little bit happen here, people.
I was shocked. I was shocked.
That's insane.
So, Zach, in that case, what happens? Now, let's take that community of fish that I just spoke about. They obviously lost the spawn that year. They must have, I'm assuming, reabsorbed their eggs and gone on their business as if it was summer.
I mean, so they might have still tried to spawn. Like a lot of times, you know, these fish will still attempt to spawn, and it's really they're spawning in places that are not suitable for their eggs. So those eggs just don't survive. Or, you know, one of the things that we think happens in these really extreme years is they'll spawn and those eggs will hatch, but then they are so mistimed with the production of their food, which is like the little zooplankton, you know, the kind of little animals that live in the water. Yeah. They're so mistimed with the production of zooplankton that there's not enough food around to support them. So they don't grow and don't survive. And that's what we think is happening with the amount of unpredictability in our ice offs now, is that what used to be a very kind of predictable succession of events from ice off to algae to zooplankton to baby fish and everything kind of works, has become very reshuffled. And now those that succession of events doesn't happen the way it needs to. And there's no food around for those baby fish and they don't survive. So, I mean, you know, in a single year, it happens. You get a bust year. They come back and try again the next year. It's really when you start stacking those bust years on top of each other that in the long term, you could see declines in your fish populations.
We have to assume, though, that at some point these fish will readjust, right, their clock, and they'll say, okay, we can't rely on that spawn time anymore, so we need to readjust and do it later. How does that work? How long does that take? I mean, they can't just wait around until they're extinct, I'm assuming. Evolution.
The problem is that evolution takes a lot longer than we would like it to when we think about, you know, needing to evolve essentially, right, to be able to retrack these new ice offs. And the other thing, if it's super unpredictable, you're also not getting that selection toward earlier all the time, right? If you throw a late year in there in the middle of everything, which we are also getting, that scrambles that whole process too. So, I mean, I think that's one of the really kind of concerning things that we saw is that, like I said, ice off is changing 3.5 times faster than walleye are. That adaptation is not occurring at near the rate it needs to happen for walleye to be able to keep up with the pace of climate change. And I think a lot of projections are that pace is even going to continue to get faster, you know, and in some lakes, you might even see cases where you start to get intermittent ice where the lakes don't even freeze consistently every year. And that's an entirely different ecosystem than when you hit that point. So, I mean, it's adaptation, I think, is a place where a lot of people have gone to. I get that question a lot. The issue is it just not happen at the pace it needs to happen for the fish to be able to keep up with the pace of climate change.
Wow. Is there a rating system or a, I don't know how you would do it in the scientific world of say a good year versus a bad year in the numbering world, like is the 25% of the fish, you know, what I'm trying to get at is a bad year like this, where a proposed bad year, where I thought we're going to be a bad year, what would be a number that we would look at as devastating to the walleye population?
You know, it can really depend on population. Some populations are crazy productive and you can get, you know, thousands of young of year reproduced in a year. And then, so maybe a good year is 1,000 or a few thousand fish is some proportion of the population. And the bad year is very few. Some lakes just don't produce that many fish, but maybe they have more stable recruitment. So, you know, I hate to be the scientist that says it depends, but it really varies lake to lake. A lot of times what we're thinking in terms of at the DNR, what we think is a good year class is getting at least 5 fish per mile in our electrofishing surveys. Wow. So that's when we go out in the fall, we shock the entire perimeter of some of these lakes. If we're catching 5 young of year walleye or baby walleye, this is fish that hatched that spring and survived to the fall, 5 of those per mile, we're feeling pretty good about that year class.
Doesn't sound like a lot, does it? Wow.
I think, you know, we're also like, I think Canadian walleye populations in general, or maybe a little bit more robust than our Wisconsin walleye populations. We may have adjusted our expectations based on what our populations can do. But yeah, here in Wisconsin, if we're catching 5 little fish per mile, and if we have a couple adults per acre, we're feeling pretty good about that population in terms of being fishable. If we're below that, that's when we start to get concerned. And we have some lakes where we catch 0 baby walleye in a survey. You know, we'll go out, shock the whole lake and come up with a goose egg. And that's very concerning. And some lakes, that happens every year. And those are lakes that we then have to make decisions about. Do we need to stock this lake, or what are our management options there?
Do you deal with each lake on its own? Or, for example, if you just mentioned, if you find a lake that has zero, obviously there's a concern and you might have to look at restocking. How many of those lakes do you need to encounter? First of all, how many lakes are you working on at any given time?
So Wisconsin has, 15,000 lakes. We get to 50 or 60 of them a year on a rotation. Okay. So, you know, in our total database, we're sampling, a few thousand of those lakes at least once every 5 to 10 years. And we have kind of different tiers of priorities too. We have lakes that we're very concerned about. We sample every year, and then lakes that we are more confident in that we get back to every 4 years or every 10 years, for example. So we're doing a lot of work, right? We go out, we do a complete estimate of the population size of walleye in the spring. And then we go back out in the fall and we look for those recruits in the fall. We have a pretty good sense of the trends of walleye populations across a lot of these lakes. And then that can inform our management. You know, we are always making decisions based on the trends. Like, we're never going to totally change management based on one bad year. But when we get a sequence of bad years, that's when we start thinking about, what are our options here?
That was the second part of my question. What constitutes a trend? So let's say you're working on 60 lakes this year. How many of those lakes do you have to find that blip, whether it's a shortage of fish, whether it's abnormal growth rate, or some of the other things that you're looking for? At what point is it called a trend and we had better start looking out for the entire population of walleye?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it can be if you go out and after two or three surveys, especially if those surveys are happening, two or three or 4 years apart, if you go out a few times in a row and you're not seeing those young fish out there, especially if you're getting total goose eggs, like I said, zeros again, then that's concerning. That suggests maybe that lake has lost natural recruitment. And, maybe we think about stocking that lake or doing some other thing, maybe habitat management, that kind of thing. Another thing we're trying to do with walleye populations in Wisconsin is thinking about what are the projections of those walleye lakes into the future. So we have some lakes where walleye are right now that we're just projecting they're simply going to get too warm for walleye to really thrive. Wow. By mid-century, the end of century, right? So maybe that's a place where you think about, well, what are our other possible opportunities here? Maybe it's going to convert to a bass, crappie, bluegill type fishery. Mm-hmm. People still like to fish for those species, so maybe that's an acceptable outcome. So that's something that we're starting to implement, particularly with walleye, using this framework called RAD, which is, a fun acronym for paper tiles and stuff. But the idea is you can either resist a change, accept the change, or direct a change. And when you have walleye populations where, maybe they're not going to thrive, maybe this lake's going to get too warm, maybe that's an accept category. If we think this lake is okay and if for some other reason walleye recruitment has declined, maybe that's a resist category and you stock that lake or manage harvest or something like that. So we have a whole kind of framework about what to do with all these different populations in different states and different types of lakes in our state.
Would you ever consider taking the walleye out of that lake that's getting warmer and warmer and putting them into a more hospitable lake for them? Or would that or just let the population die off?
We've done some adult transfers in special cases, but most of our stocking is, going out, collecting eggs, raising those, hatching those eggs and raising those eggs in a hatchery and then restocking. We're pretty careful in Wisconsin about moving particularly adult fish around because of things like diseases. And we also don't necessarily, we have a few different genetic strains of walleye in our state and we don't want to mix those up too much either. Yeah. So we're trying to kind of make sure we're always stocking from the same strain kind of thing. So, adult movement is something we don't do a ton yet.
On a side note, give us a couple of those strains. The differences, I've never heard of different strains of walleye. That's interesting. What have you got there?
Sure. I mean, so it's really kind of based on the main drainages. So we have like a Great Lakes kind of strain that's kind of in the tributaries and lakes that drain to the Great Lakes. And then we also have a Mississippi River strain. Those are kind of big ones. And then there's also in the northwest part of our state, a different strain there that I think kind of goes off toward the northwest, and I forget what the name of that strain is right now. But so we have a few different major strains, and those are the ones we are trying not to mix up too much. Because, as you get kind of different environments, these walleye can have different, you know, temperature preferences or slightly different behaviors, different growth rates, that kind of thing. And, you know, if you move one from one place to another where it's not used to being, not adapted to, it might not survive very well. So that's something we always try and keep track of.
Interesting. We interrupt this program to bring you the much anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is FIZZ. That's F-I-Z-Z, FIZZ. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those of you who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode, click contests, and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the episode.
It's funny listening to Zach about, you know, they have to prepare for the eventuality if it's in the cards that that fish is going to be replaced by another species in those conditions and waters.
Right.
And you mentioned crappie, which we are finding more and more of here as things warm up. I mean, lakes that you never even heard of crappie in before now are some of the targets for crappie anglers all over the north.
Yeah.
So that we see that change happening already, but a real interesting thing popped in my head. You know, Pete and I love walleye fishing. We love walleye. We've been fishing them all of our lives. So when we hear stuff like this to us, we, or at least I'm thinking, no, you can't think that way. You have to do everything you can to keep walleye intact. But yet here in Eastern Canada, the fight has been with the Atlantic salmon. And because you and I are not connected to the Atlantic salmon, when folks from those areas are saying, my God, we can't live without the Atlantic salmon anymore, we're saying, hey, take a break. Look what's happening. You got great striped bass coming in. You got smallmouth bass. You got muskie. You got all these other species that you never had before that are now filling in for the Atlantic salmon. But that's because we're not connected to them. But now when we hear that story from Zach regarding walleye, we're saying, oh, how can that even be happening?
Replace a bunch of walleye with crappie? Nah, I don't like that. I don't want that.
One man's treasure is another man's trash is all I got to say about that.
Exactly. I mean, I think we always joke in Wisconsin that our state fish should really be anything that bites. Because if you go out and talk to the average angler, that's what they tell you they're fishing for, right? So the important thing to point out is that I think – you know, there are still going to be walleye on the landscape. Like, we have a project right now that's looking at these walleye kind of bright spots, we call them, and trying to understand what makes those places so good. And then can we learn from those about management for other places that are maybe struggling? But the other thing is, you know, a lot of our anglers are pretty flexible and willing to go out and fish for other things. And it's really, in some ways, priming the angling public about what those new opportunities could be. Just like you said, with Atlantic salmon too, right? Like, there's not lots of new possible things you could do and opportunities. And if you really want to fish for walleye, maybe you have to drive a little bit further, but there's still going to be lakes out there that have walleye. So those opportunities are still going to be there for you too.
I'll tell you, our Atlantic salmon community, though, they're not too happy with the smallmouth, the stripers, and the muskies. I'll tell you, they don't even want to look at them. They, you know, it's a total invasion on their fish and their territory and all that. So I don't know if they're accepting as well as some people would for bass versus walleye, maybe, but it is what it is, right?
You have to look within to see the, you know, how other people react to things, because we'd react the same way.
Yep.
If it was bass or walleye.
If they were largemouth, we're getting replaced with bullheads or something.
Exactly.
Like that, you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. So,
as anglers, now I think most real walleye anglers are in tune with what we've heard here today from you, that things are changing and things are going to continue to change. They're not going back to where they were. They're only going to get a little more abstract from where they were. What, as anglers, what can we do to maybe mitigate some of these problems and extend the life for walleye in areas?
That's always a really great question. And I think the thing I always like to turn to is think about the things you can control versus the things that are hard to control, right? So if we think climate change, for example, is a stress around walleye, well, it's pretty hard to control the amount of carbon in the atmosphere with your lake association, right? But there are things you can do at your lake to make it more resilient to the effects of climate change. So that could be things like reducing harvest, if we think harvest is a problem. For example, in Wisconsin, we just reduced our bag limit from 5 fish to 3 for walleye. So, nice. You know, trying to take care of that. But you can also do things like we already talked about spawning habitat, you know, management practices to either improve spawning habitat, keep that spawning habitat inundated in the springtime. Just general land use practices, right? Keeping nutrients out of your lake, keeping those kind of cold, oxygenated waters healthy for your walleye, providing the habitat for walleye, preventing the movement of invasive species. So things like zebra mussels, bithotrephes, which is this predatory zooplankton that eats the zooplankton that young walleye also eat. So they actually compete, which is pretty interesting. So there are a number of things that you can do to try and keep your lakes resilient to the effects of climate change, which is difficult to control. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff in your kind of toolbox among the things you can control that you can think about doing on your lake.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah.
And I think most walleye anglers would volunteer those things, you know, limiting their catch, for example. We have a lake not too far from this studio that we use as a benchmark all the time in walleye fishing. It's called Lake Scugog. It used to be one of the most prolific walleye fisheries on the planet, and it was no more than an hour away from 6 million people. So mm-hmm. very close, tremendous access, everything you could imagine in a walleye fishery. And every day, thousands of walleye anglers would be on this lake harvesting walleye like crazy. And even through the ice, because it also had a tremendous ice fishery for walleye. Mm-hmm. Not a very big lake, by the way, just so that you know, if you're not familiar with it, not a huge lake. But and growing up, we sort of grew up through this, and it just kept giving and kept giving and kept giving until at one point it stopped or slowed down giving. And mm-hmm. the MNRF worked on it for a few years and determined that the walleye population, in fact, was in peril. And they asked anglers, I think it was about an 8-month online questionnaire. They asked anglers to have some input on what should happen next. What should the next step be? And in that case, and I don't think it'll ever happen again, but I'm just giving you this because this is real data. Pretty much 100% of the respondents said, it's fine. Leave it alone. We don't want to limit our catches to 2 fish from 6. We don't want to. One of the things on there was, would you be willing to look at a season that's based on months? In other words, open June, close July, open January, close February, like that kind of thing. And everybody just said, leave it alone. It'll be fine. So MNRF took all of this and they finally, after months, they determined that they were going to take the lead role on this, and they closed it down completely. And it's wow. still shut down now for walleye.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like it's going to open in the near future.
And that's I was sure. speaking to somebody last week at the show we were at, and just to get some insight on yeah. that. And it doesn't look, it's not even that, no, we're looking at it, you know, we're trying to determine yeah. whether it's on a rebound yeah. and no, yeah. they're just leaving it alone right yeah. now. There's no possibility. And this was a lake, Zach, and I'm not kidding you, you know, you get off work at 5 o'clock and you and your buddy jumped in the car and you drove the 20 minutes to Scugog every night of the week after work and you caught a limit of walleye and brought them home. Everybody mm-hmm. did that because that was okay to do. Mm-hmm. Thousands of fish were being pulled out of that system every year. And to the point where it finally just gave up. I mention that because I think today as anglers, we have evolved. I do believe that if that were to happen again today, that the answers would be much different than they were back in 2015 when this happened. Do you agree with that assessment? Or do you think we're still just knuckle-dragging Neanderthals that just need to have our line yanked and catch some fish?
I agree with that assessment. I'm actually surprised that the public was so against limiting the fishery in that case, because in Wisconsin we've had similar cases, like the Minocqua chain of lakes, which is in the very northern part of Wisconsin up by Lake Superior. that's been under a no harvest regulation for some time now for the same reason. It just quit producing fish, and they went out, and there was support for trying to do something to save this walleye population, and they closed it entirely. Both Wisconsin has a tribal fisheries and a recreational fishery, and both of those agreed to stop fishing the Monaco chain. And whenever we talk to anglers about reducing bag limits or reducing fishing pressure on walleye or other species, even panfish like bluegill and crappie and stuff, people are generally pretty favorable about reducing regulation. I think a lot of the attitudes have changed where you no longer need to bring home your six walleye or your 50 bluegills or whatever, because, you know, if you bring home 50 bluegills, who wants to spend the hours you have to clean them at night anyway, right? So you just kind of, you go out and you catch what you want to keep, and then you're good for the day. And I think that attitude and the recognition that the fisheries have changed so much has led to a lot more acceptance of tighter regulations on these populations. So yeah, I'd be very curious if they went out and did that survey again, what the response would be, because in Wisconsin, whenever we ask that question, people are generally favorable for it.
I think today it would be a slam dunk the other way.
I think we'd hope for it anyways.
Oh, for sure.
People, you know what? They're reducing the limits everywhere anyways. There's no more six walleye in this province anywhere, right? It's a four at max, and then there's a lot of stipulations on the size of them too, with the slots, et cetera, et cetera.
I hate to bring this up, but, you know, this is probably the perfect time because we have a doctor who works south of the border and maybe is not as familiar with our situation here. I think one of the problems that happened on Lake Scugog, by the way, and this is by no means a reflection of our immigration policies in this country, but part of the problem on Scugog, I mentioned to you before, access to 5 or 6 million people, you know, in an urban center, could literally be there in 20 minutes and have at it. And I think one of the problems was the lack of education that we offered our angling immigrants at the time.
Our new anglers
on you know, the proper do's and don'ts on walleye fishing. Well, never mind walleye fishing, just fishing in general. Because most of these folks, when they saw that they had an opportunity, and still to this day see that they have an opportunity to fish here, it's free, it's open, there's very few restrictions. They come from countries where that was stifled. They didn't have free and open fishing opportunities. So this coming here, this is a whole different ball game. And so I want to attribute some of what happened here to that. You know, we had millions of people coming into this area from other parts of the world who were not as familiar with catch and release, who were not as familiar with limiting your harvest. They just saw this as an opportunity. Oh my God. You mean we could go there every day and catch fish from the roadside free and take it home? That's a big thing, you know.
Sure it is.
And I don't think we pay enough attention to that. And I think one of the mistakes that we made back then, and I say we, I mean maybe MNRF, is that they didn't realize the impact that that immigration was going to have on, in this case, walleye fishing, of all things.
Right.
You know,
I think in general, there's still the average angler is still uneducated, everybody. Not just new anglers, all anglers, as to the laws, the rules, the regulations, and the changes every year. Because there are a lot of changes every year. And then maybe even it's a few, but most people don't even look at these new changes, these new regulations. And then they get to a lake and they find out, oh my God, we're fishing in a sanctuary. Oh my God, we're fishing in, you know, these fish are illegal to keep. I can't believe this 22-inch walleye. I think you have to push the regulations. I'm sure in Wisconsin Ontario for sure. I think worldwide, if there's regulations to be written, that people need to be educated with it. And I don't think people really take too much of a note to it. So that's unfortunate.
There's a book. Go check it out.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I got my fishing license. I'm going fishing, right? Yeah. So, but anyways, Zach, I got a question for you. Now, so we're going back to this 2024 thing. We're for anybody listening, we're in the spring of 2024 right now. Maybe our walleye here, maybe even Zach's walleye in Wisconsin, are very close to spawning, if they're going to spawn, successful in that. You always talk about year class. How many years will it take for us to know how successful or unsuccessful this 2024 spawn for walleye was?
I think we will have a pretty good idea, potentially, at least in Wisconsin, by this fall, and definitely by next fall. So we go out and we're catching those fish in the fall of the year that they were spawned. So now they're you know, when we're catching them, it's in October, so they're somewhere between 4 and 8 inches long. And if we catch a lot of those fish, we're feeling pretty good about the size of that year class. And we'll go out and we'll also sample them again at age one, so the following fall. And then by then, if they're still there and still there, still doing good, like we're feeling pretty confident about it. So I think, okay. you know, but we could tell pretty quickly whether we're going to have a good year class or not, how well it recruits to the fishery, you know, in Wisconsin, our lake limit, or we think of kind of recruiting to the fishery is getting to like 15 inches, 18 inches, somewhere in there. That can take 3 to 5 years, kind of depending on the lake. So that'll take a few more years. But usually, if you just want to kind of know how many of these eggs survive to make fish that might make it to the next generation, it's a year or two. It's actually pretty quick.
So that's from a scientific standpoint.
Right.
From an angling, I think that's what you were asking. From an angler standpoint, when do we see the ramifications of this change? Is it 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road as anglers?
I think as an angler, you're probably looking at like 3 to 5 years. It might be a little bit longer in places where growth is a little slower. But in Wisconsin, you know, we're thinking a 15-inch fish is entering the fishery, the recreational fishery. And that's, you know, a 3 to 5 year a time. So again, you know, it can be pretty quick, and you can also then feel the effects of those missing year classes pretty quick then as well. You know, 3 or 4 years after you have a couple of bust years, all of a sudden you've really lost a big chunk of your fishery there.
If you as a scientific community see this year in the fall, oh my God, the spawn was a horrible thing. And do you change the regulations to that? Or do you say, okay, let's let things go work out? Or do you have suggested changes of maybe 2 fish limits instead of 3? Or is it just say, let's just take a chance? What's that?
So in Wisconsin, we used to have a much more dynamic system, this kind of sliding bag limit where the bag could slide from 1 to 5 based on kind of conditions. And we actually went away from that because we felt it was too reactive. It was also way too confusing for anglers. You know, talked about like having to know what the regulations are, and if they're sliding on different lakes and you go from one lake to the next, it kind of is very confusing for folks. So now we're much more consistent with our regulations. And as I said, we're really not looking to make big changes unless we have a pretty strong trend of a few of those years in a row where you have poor recruitment. So we're not going to make a decision based on one bust, because again, if the next year is good, you're still going to be able to support your fisheries.
Right.
When really what you've gotten in a sequence of 3 to 5 or even longer time periods with no recruitment, that's when you get concerned that, you know, you're not going to have the fish around to fish for.
Okay.
By the way, Zach, I wasn't going to say anything, but I have to ask you about that picture you've got hanging on the wall behind you.
Sure. Yeah.
First of all, what's that? The predator species there?
That's actually, this is a reef photo. So that's a parrotfish. Okay. And then I'm actually not sure what that big ball of fish is. So that's something that we bought from like a National Geographic kind of photo thing. It's cool. So I put it in my office. But yeah, it's a fun picture to have behind my head.
The reason I ask is we see that image every week that we go out fishing on our new electronics that Garmin has come up with. The technology today allows us to see exactly that image below the water, and it's just changed everything that we do, because that's what we go looking for now. Instead of just, especially walleye, instead of just going out fishing aimlessly, we see when they're in that mode, that feeding mode like that, and have at them. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've taken you for a lot longer than we had agreed to originally, so we really appreciate you staying with us all this time. It's going to be an ongoing thing, obviously, as things change, positions from a scientific standpoint, positions are going to be made, lines are going to be drawn in the sand, and we as anglers are going to have to abide by whatever the scientific community suggests to us. So we'd like to ask if we can impose on you in the future as your studies go. And by the way, where can folks get maybe a little more information on what you're working on? Can they look over your shoulder on these annual things? Where can that be had?
Sure. So at the Wisconsin DNR, they have a project webpage for our phenology project. So if you Google the DNR Office of Applied Science, we have a whole list of projects, and not just my research, but all the research that all of our great scientists at the DNR are doing. And that's a really great place to go and get started on kind of understanding what we're looking at and thinking about. Now I say, yes, please do impose on me. I really enjoy this conversation. Thank you. If you ever want to talk fishing technology, that's actually another area of research of mine. So I'm happy to talk about that. So
that's next.
happy to talk more sometime.
Perfect.
Thank you, my friend. And once again, thank you very much. We will talk to you very soon, and best of luck with your studies.
Sounds great. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Zach.
Wow. Okay.
I'm loving this fish dock with the dock stuff.
Absolutely.
This is good stuff.
Absolutely. You know? An interesting thing there, and I wanted to ask him, but I missed out on it. I wanted to find out if the lifespan of walleye in Wisconsin or in his area that they're studying, if it would differ much from our walleye here.
We're geographically pretty close.
Pretty close, right? I wanted to find out how... Because we always, people ask us, how long, well, they last, they're 10 years old. Right. We make this stuff up, okay? Let's be honest about it. I wanted to find out from Zach.
I like Zach's point of there's a 5 walleye per mile. And I said, if you and I get onto that, we're doing good. Me? We can't get 5 miles per walleye. Jeez, like, what the hell's going on here?
That's interesting. I know how everybody has a different bar.
Yeah.
A different
because it does, you know, you think about a mile of water, that's a lot of water. Only 5 little walleye. I don't even know there's a lot more than 5 there, obviously. That's when they've captured 5, but still,
each one of those probably represents
20 or whatever, right, or 5 or 10 or something. Yeah, but it just doesn't sound so minuscule, that number, right? You know what I mean? So,
we should have asked them what that does represent.
Equate to
what's
next time we get them on. We'll,
there's a lot of questions already. You've only been off for 30 seconds and we already have questions. But anyways, I love it. I love the way we can, take what they're doing there in Wisconsin, maybe apply it here, maybe look at our walleye fishery here.
I'm assuming that. Yeah. Would you not think that our biologists and DNR would probably be looking into the other, you know, I would think our MNRs and DNRs are working together, but hopefully they are anyways. So.
Got to find out. Next time on Fish Talk with the Doc, maybe we should find a local scientist.
Yeah.
Yep. See what we can do.
Agreed.
All right, that are it, folks. We got to move on. My God, that went longer than we had intended.
That's good stuff. That's why it went on, buddy, because it's good stuff. He's a great speaker, too.
What a wonderful. You know? He's going to be a regular.
Yeah.
You know what we got to do? Here's what I'm going to do right now. I'm going to say that what we should do is that we should have a Fish Talk with the Doc t-shirt made up. And each time that one of these scientists appears in Fish Talk with the Doc, we ship him a shirt. How's that?
I like that. And if he's done. And if he's not really that great a guest, we'll just send him one of these right here.
Perfect.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
There you go. Anyways, on behalf of the entire team, Vovo over there behind the camera.
Give me a hell yeah.
Vovo's going to be leaving for a few weeks very shortly.
Wow.
In a couple of days.
I'm going to miss him.
And hopefully we will be able to tell you that story when he comes back. Nikki's still ill, so he's not in his seat. Dean Taylor, our producer, over in the corner. My co-host, Peter Bowman. I'm Angela Viola. Thanks, folks. We'll catch you next time.